It had made only three running jumps before the weight of the hunter smashed its spine into jagged shards. Taloned fingers tore aside the ewe's flesh, and the blood ran. The beast ate swiftly, lifting its shaggy black head often, peering short-sightedly around the mountainside, ready for any enemy that might chance upon it. It was uncomfortable out in the open, unused to shimmering horizons and bright light. But the blood was good upon its tongue, the flesh rich and greasy. Casually, it ripped out the ewe's entrails, hurling them far from its body, concentrating instead on the flesh of the loins. Slowly, methodically, the giant creature fed, snapping bones and sucking out the marrow, splitting the skull with one blow and devouring the brains. Hunger, satisfied, the beast sank back to its haunches. It blinked in the sunlight as an image fashioned itself in its mind. A bright image. Grunting, it shook its head, then gave a low growl. Dimly, it remembered the circle of stones and the red-clad sorcerer whose fingers danced with fire. The fire had entered the creature's breast, settling there without pain. The beast howled as hunger returned. It would always be hungry, until it devoured the image woman. Angrily, the beast slammed its hands against the ground. Away to the left, it saw the line of trees that merged into the forest above Valon. Hunger returning, it began to lope towards them, stopping at a stream to drink. The trees were smaller than the ones it had known and climbed, less closely packed and strangely silent. No chittering monkeys swung from the vines. Few birds sang, and there was no sign of fruit upon the boughs. The wind shifted, and a new smell filtered to the beast's flaring nostrils. The black eyes glittered with a memory of salty, sweet flesh and marrow-filled bones. The sorcerer had implanted a soul scent upon its senses, and this creature was not the victim ordained, nor was the spell scent close by. Yet it could almost taste the sweet meat of the approaching man-beast. Saliva dripped from its maw, and its dark tongue licked out over its fangs. The smell was growing stronger. There was no need to stalk, for the simple-minded creature was moving this way. 100 paces to the west, Erlik of the Pallades, a tall young hunter from the house of Margrig, leaned on his staff. Beside him his warhound Askar growled deep in his throat. Erlik was puzzled. An hour ago he had seen the blue haze across the mountains and the two suns appear in the sky, and despite this being Farlan land, he had ventured here, led by the curiosity of the young. Less than a year before, Erlik had gained his manhood in the hunt and was now a contender for the games. And where a more seasoned veteran would hesitate, Erlik, with all the confidence of youth, had crossed the border and ventured into the lands of the enemy. He did not fear Farlan hunters, for he knew he could outrun them. But he had to know why the air burned blue. He sensed it would be a fine tale to tell his comrades at the evening feast. He leaned down and stroked Askar, whispering it to silence. The hound obeyed unwillingly. It didn't like the idea of moving with the direction of the breeze, and it sensed danger ahead, which made the fur on its shoulders rise. With the natural cunning of the canine, it began to edge left, but Erlik called it back. The young hunter moved forward, towards an area of thick bracken and gorse. Askar growled once more, and this time the dog's unease filtered through to the man. Carefully, he laid down his quarterstaff, then swung his bow from his shoulder, hastily notching an arrow to the string. The gorse exploded as a vast black creature reared up from the ground at Erlik's feet. A taloned arm flashed out, half-severing the hunter's left arm and hurling him to the ground. The warhound leapt for the beast's throat, but was brutally swatted aside. Erlik drew his hunting knife and struggled to rise, but the talons flashed once more, and his head toppled from his shoulders. Minutes later, the warhound came to its senses, pain gnawing at its broken ribs. The great head came up slowly, ears pricking at the sounds of crunching bones. with infinite care, the hound inched its way to the west, away from the feeding beast. In the valley of the Farlan, 14 teams of youngsters were packing shoulder sacks with provisions, ready for the hunt. Families and kin thronged the market field. The brothers Lane and Lennox were seated side by side on a fallen oak, while Galen lay on his back, eyes closed, nearby. Beside him sat the slender Gwalchmai, whittling with a short dagger.
"I wish they would announce the start," said Lane. "What are they waiting for?"
Galen sat up.
"Caswellan said the druid must give his blessing."
"I know that," snapped Lane. "I meant, why the delay?"
Galen lay back on the grass and said nothing. Lane was not normally this edgy.
"Are you looking forward to it?" asked Gwalchmai.
Galen could see that the ginger-haired youth was worried by Lane's tension and seeking to change the mood.
"Yes, I am," said Galen.
"Do you understand the meaning of the riddle?"
"No. Have you deciphered it?"
Gwalchmai shrugged.
"Maybe it will be clearer when we find the second clue."
In the house of Campbell, beyond the field and the waiting teams, sat the druid lord Taliesin. Opposite him, pacing before the hearth, was the tall hunt lord Campbell, a golden-haired, handsome young man wearing a leaf-green tunic and a red cloak. By the hearth sat a stranger clad in leather shirt and breeches, his long blonde hair braided beneath a round leather helm. He too was handsome, but unlike Campbell, there was no softness in him. His eyes were the cold blue of the winter sky, and upon his mouth was a mocking half-smile. That the druid disliked him was obvious, and seemed to amuse the Aeneir. But for Campbell the meeting was a monstrous embarrassment. The druid was angry, though he showed nothing of it as he sipped water from a clay goblet. Campbell was uneasy, and pulled at his golden beard. The stranger sat back in the leather-covered chair, his face expressionless.
"It is rare," the druid said at last, "for a stranger to be present at the youth's hunt, though it is not without precedent. There shall be no blessing today, for the words of power cannot be spoken in the presence of lowlanders. In this there is no disrespect intended for your guest, Campbell. It is merely the weight of tradition which forbids it."
Campbell bit his lip and nodded.
"May I ask," continued the druid, "that we speak privately?"
Campbell turned to the man beside him.
"My apologies, Lord Drutter. But please feel free to join the men at the food table beyond and refresh yourself."
Drutter stood and bowed to Campbell. Then he turned to the druid.
"I am sorry to have caused you problems. Had I known my presence would disrupt the ceremony, I would have turned down the invitation."
Neither Taliesin nor Campbell missed the stress he placed on the word invitation, and the hunt lord felt himself blushing. The Aeneir warrior carefully hung his black cloak upon his broad shoulders and left the room, closing the door quietly behind him. The ancient druid turned his dark eyes on the hunt lord and leaned forward across the table.
"It was not wise to invite him into Farland lands," he said. "He is friendly enough," insisted Campbell. "He is the enemy to come," snapped the druid. "So you say, old man. But I am the hunt lord of the Farland, and I alone decide whether a man is a friend or enemy. You are a druid, and as such are to be respected in religious matters, but do not exceed your authority." "Are you blind, Campbell? Or merely stupid?"
Anger shone in the hunt lord's eyes, but his response was calm.
"I am not blind, druid, and I make no great claims to be wiser than any other clansman. What I do know is that war brings no advantage to either side. If the Aeneir can be convinced that we offer them no threat, and that there is no wealth to be found in the mountains, I see no reason why we cannot exist together, if not as friends, then at least as good neighbours. Keeping them out will only cause suspicion and make war more likely."
Campbell walked to the door, wrenching it open.
"Now, the boys are waiting, and I shall send them off, and I don't doubt that the lack of your words of power will affect them not at all."
At the edge of the field, Caswellan sat with Meg and Corrine, watching the boys line up for the first race to the trees. Once there, they would find a leather pouch hanging from the branch of the central pine. Within the pouch were four clues, written on parchment. The first team to reach the tree would be able to read all the clues and remove one. The next team would find three clues and remove one, and so on until the fourth team would find only one remaining. Galen, who could not yet read, would be useless to his team on this first run, but they had chosen Gwalchmai to lead the sprint, and he was almost as fast as Campbell's son Agwain. The team sprinted away at Campbell's command, and Caswellan watched as Gwalchmai and Agwain forged a lead over the rest, with Galen loping beside the lumbering Lennox at the rear. At that moment, Caswellan caught sight of the black-coated Aenea warrior standing by the grey house. Leaving Meg and Corrine, he walked the short distance to the building. As he walked, he gauged the man. The Aenea was tall and well-built, but slim of hip. He looked what he was, a warrior. As Caswellan approached, the man turned, and the clansman knew he was undergoing the same appraisal.
"The lads move well," said the Aenea, pointing towards the youngsters who were now halfway up the hillside.
"I see your men took my advice," said Caswellan. "That was wise."
Drada smiled.
"Yes, I always listen to wise counsel, but I saw no sign of the fallen hunters you promised to send after us."
"They were there."
"I was surprised to find you are not a counselor, Caswellan."
"Why so?"
"I gained the impression that you were a man of influence, but Campbell tells me that is not so. He says you are a thief and a bandit."
"What do you think of the Farland Mountains?" Caswellan countered.
"They are beautiful, most especially this valley."
"There are many valleys in the Farland, and a vast number more in the Druin Range," said the clansman. "I have no doubt I shall see them all, eventually,"
Drada told him, with a wolfish smile.
"Travel alone when you do so."
"Really? Why?"
"The mountains can be tranquil, and a man alone can best enjoy their harmony."
"And if he is not alone?" asked Drada.
"If he travels with many, then the mountains can be hostile, even deadly.
Why, even now two Aenea corpses are rotting in the mountains, and there is room for many more."
"That is no talk for new friends, Caswellan."
Caswellan laughed with genuine humour. Then the smile faded.
"But then, I am not your friend, my bonnie, nor ever shall be."
More than 50 youngsters pounded up the slope, feet drumming on the hard-packed, grass-covered clay of the hillside. Gwalchmai tucked himself in behind Agwain, fastening his eyes on the other boy's pack, and running on grimly. After 40 paces, he loosened the straps of his own heavy pack and let it fall to the ground behind him. Then, as Galen had instructed him, he once more moved up behind Agwain. Here the hillside was at its steepest, and the young Agwain was breathing heavily. His legs began to burn as the body's waste acid settled to the muscles of his calves. He did not look back. He could afford no wasted energy. And besides, he was the fastest runner for his years in the Farlan. Back down the slope, Lennox scooped up Gwalchmai's pack and continued to lope alongside Galen, way to the rear of the other runners.
"I hope this is allowed," shouted Lennox.
Galen said nothing. Caswellan had told him that the rules were specific.
All runners had to start the race carrying their own provisions. Well, Gwalchmai had done that.
Lane had not been easy to convince, for he was a youth who lived on traditions of honour, and would sooner lose than cheat. But Galen had called a vote, as was his right, and had won the day. Lane seemed to harbour no grudge. Gwalchmai and Agwain had now increased their lead over the following pack to 50 paces, and it was obvious that they would reach the trees well ahead of their rivals. As the timberline neared, Gwalchmai sped past his astonished opponent. Agwain was furious. Sweat-soaked and near exhausted, he released his pack and set off after the sprinting youth. Fury pumped fresh adrenaline to his tired legs, and against all the odds, he began to close the gap. 50 paces from the trees, Agwain was running in Gwalchmai's shadow, But the canny youngster had one more ploy. As Agwain came abreast of him, Gwalchmai kicked again, releasing the energy he had held in reserve. Agwain had nothing more to offer. In an agonizing effort to match his opponent, he stumbled against a stone and pitched to the earth. Gwalchmai ran ahead, eyes flickering from tree to tree, seeking the pouch. It was in plain view, fastened to a low branch. He pulled it clear, removing the small pieces of paper it contained. Reading them all, he selected one and tucked it in his belt. Then he rehung the pouch and wandered back towards Agwain. The Hunt Lord's son ignored him, racing past to tear the pouch clear. He read the three remaining strips, took one and replaced two. Then he turned after Gwalchmai.
"You dog!" he shouted, his breathing laboured. "You cheating car!"
Frightened, Gwalchmai backed and opened his hands.
"The rules did not forbid it, Agwain!"
Other runners came between them in the last frantic dash for clues, and Agwain turned away to sit in the shade of a spreading elm. Gwalchmai was grinning broadly as Lane reached him, and he handed the parchment over. Lane read it, nodded, then walked over to where Agwain was sitting.
"Well run, cousin,"
he said, squatting beside him.
"Thank you. That was a devious strategy. But, as Gwalchmai says, it was within the rules and therefore I can have no complaint."
Lane offered Agwain the parchment.
"What is this? What are you doing?"
"There may be nothing in the rules against our tactic," said Lane, "but I am not happy with it. Here, read the line, and from now we start level."
"No, cousin," said Agwain, gripping the other's shoulder, "though I thank you for your courtesy. I must confess that were I not the fastest runner, it is likely I would have used the tactic myself. I take it the Lowlander conceived it."
"Yes."
"Yes, quick wits. I'll give him that."
Lane nodded. Then he stood and returned to the others, who had been watching the scene, puzzled.
"Let's find a place out of earshot and discuss our next move," he said, walking past them to the trees.
Galen bit back his anger and followed. He had seen Lane offer the clue to Agwain and noted the other's refusal. It was confusing and deeply irritating. In a deep hollow, away from the crowds, the four squatted in a huddled circle. Lane nodded to Gwalchmai, who began to speak in a hushed whisper. They were all aware that those teams without clues would now seek to follow and spy on the leading four.
"The clues were simple to understand," whispered Gwalchmai. "The one we have is the simplest, that which Eris lost. So it is a sword we seek. The other clues confirm it. A king's sorrow, the light that brings darkness, and the bane of Eska. The question now is, where is it hidden?" "It's hidden at or near Atifos," whispered Galen.
"What?" said Lane, astonished. "How do you know?"
"The rhyme. Seek the beast that no one finds, always roaring, never silent. When Caswallon took me to Atifos, it sounded like a great monster, but when we arrived there was no monster, merely a roaring fall of water."
"It could be," said Lane.
"What do you think, Gwal?"
"I agree with Galen."
"Lennox?"
The youth raised his shoulders in a non-committal shrug.
"So," said Lane, "we are agreed."
"Well done, Galen. If we look at the rest of the verse, it becomes even more obvious. Beneath its skin by silver wings, bring forth the lost dream of kings. The blade is hidden under the water, guarded by fishes. But where? Atifos is huge.
There will be other clues," said Gwalchmai. "We must follow the right tracks."
"True," said Lane.
"All right, we'll make camp higher up in the trees, then slip away before dawn and strike for Valon."
Dawn found the four of them miles from the first timber and well on their way. Lane led them down rocky slopes and over difficult terrain, constantly checking on what tracks they were leaving. By mid-morning, he was content. Even the most skillful hunters would have difficulty finding them, and above all, the task would be time-consuming. As they strolled through patches of yellow-gold gorse and across meadows bedecked with blooms, Galen rediscovered the strange sense of joy he first felt when Caswellan formally adopted him. He was home. Truly home. Beside him, Gwalchmai was whistling a merry tune, and ahead, Lane and Lennox were deep in conversation. Galen rubbed at his scarred eye, for it itched now and then, usually when he was tired.
"Is it troubling you?" asked Gwalchmai.
Galen shook his head, and Gwalchmai resumed whistling, but his thoughts remained on the youngster beside him. Gwalchmai had liked Galen from the first. He didn't know why, but then he rarely rationalized such things. He relied on his emotions to steer him, and they rarely played him false. He remembered his shock when he first saw the boy, his red hair streaked with a white slash, his left eye filled with blood, for all the world like a ruby set in his skull. He had been prepared to dislike the lowlander, having listened to Agwain speak sneeringly of Caswellan's rescue. But there had been something about the way Galen carried himself, like a clansman, tall and proud. Gwalchmai stopped whistling, as he noticed a track some 10 paces from the trail.
"Lane!" he called. "Hold on!"
Gwalchmai stepped from the trail and knelt by the soft earth beside the gorse. The three companions gathered around him, staring in wonder at the footprint.
"It's as long as my forearm," said Gwalchmai. "And look, the thing has 6 toes.
All four lads scouted back along the line of tracks, but they found nothing. The earth by the gorse was soft, but the surrounding ground was rocky and firm.
"What do you think it is?"
asked Galen, whose knowledge of mountain animals was still sparse.
"It isn't anything I've ever seen," said Gwalchmai.
"Lane?" The leader grinned suddenly.
"It's perfectly obvious, my friends. It's a hunter's joke. When they were laying the trails for our hunt, they made a jest of the rhyme, 'Seek the beast.' The footprint points towards Valen, and the print was created to show we're on the right track."
Gwalchmai's freckled face split into a grin.
"Yes, of course," he said.
An hour before nightfall, Lane scouted a small hollow where they could build a fire against a towering granite stone. The tiny blaze could not be seen from any distance, and the four travellers unrolled their blankets and settled down for a light meal of oatcakes and water. As the night closed in and the stars shone bright, Lennox curled up like a dozing bear and slept, leaving the others seated by the fire, talking in low voices.
"Who was Aerys?"
Galen asked, as he fed the fire with dry sticks.
"The first High King," Lane told him. "Hundreds of years ago, the Farlan lived in another land, beyond the gates. There was a great war, and the clans were nigh obliterated. Aerys gathered the remains of the defeated army and launched one last desperate assault on the enemy, smashing their army and killing their leader, Eska. But it was only one of several armies facing him. The Druids told the king of a way to save his people, but it was hazardous. They had to pass a gate between worlds. I don't know much about that side of it, but the legends are many. Anyway, Aerys brought the Farland here, and we named the mountains Druin. During the journey, a strange thing happened. As Aerys stepped through the gate of Valen into the bitter cold of winter, his sword disappeared from his hand. Aerys took his crown and hurled it back through the gate. The sword, he said, was the symbol of kingship, and since it had gone, so too would his position. From henceforth, there would be no king for the Farlan. The council voted him to the position of Hunt Lord, and so it has remained."
"I see," said Galen.
"So, the Bane of Eska, that is a clue I can understand. But why the light that brings darkness?"
"The sword was called Scalivar, meaning starlight on the mountain," said Gwalchmai. "But in battle, whoever touched it found only the darkness of death."
"And that is what we seek? Scalivar?"
Lane laughed. "No, just a sword. It makes the clues more poetic, that's all."
Galen nodded. "There is much still to learn."
"But you will learn, cousin," said Lane. Galen felt a surge of warmth and comradeship within him as Lane spoke. But it was shattered by a sound that ripped through the night. An eerie, inhuman howling echoed through the mountains. Lennox awoke with a start.
"What was that?"
he asked, rolling to his knees. Galen shuddered and said nothing. "Have no idea," said Lane. "Perhaps it's a wolf, and the sound is distorted."
"If it is a wolf," muttered Gwalchmai, "it must be as big as a horse."
For several minutes they sat in silence, straining to hear any more sounds in the blackness of the night. But there was nothing. Lennox went back to sleep. Lane exchanged glances with Gwalchmai.
"It wasn't a wolf, Lane."
"No, but it could have been a hunter trying to frighten us."
"I hope so," said Gwalchmai. "I think we should stand watches tonight, though."
Chapter 4 Galen awoke at Gwalchmai's touch, his eyes flaring open, his troubled dreams fragmented and instantly forgotten.
"I can't keep my eyes open any longer," whispered Gwalchmai. "I don't think there's anything out there. I saw a fox, that's all."
Galen sat up and yawned.
"It's chilly," he whispered.
Gwalchmai rolled himself swiftly into his blanket, laying his head on his pack. Within seconds he was asleep. Galen stretched, then crept to the fire, easing himself past Lennox. Taking a dry stick, he poked around the embers of the dying fire, gently blowing it to life. Adding more sticks, he watched the flames flicker and billow. Then he looked away. Caswellan had told him never to stare into a fire, for the brightness made the pupils contract, and when you looked away into darkness you would be blind. Galen wrapped his blanket round his shoulders and leaned back against the granite boulder. An owl hooted, and the boy's fingers curled around the hilt of his hunting knife.
"You fool," he told himself. "You've never been afraid of the dark. Calm down. These are your mountains. There is nothing to harm you."
Except wolves, bears, lions, and whatever made that bestial howling. Galen shuddered and fed more sticks to the fire. The supply was growing short, and he didn't relish the prospect of entering the menacing darkness of the surrounding trees to replenish the store. Slowly, the fire died and Galen cursed softly. He had hoped it would last until first light, when the woods would become merely trees and not the frightening sentinels they now appeared. He stood up, loosening the dagger in its sheath, and walked carefully toward a fallen elm at the edge of the woods. Swiftly he collected dead wood and thicker branches. Back at the fire, relief washed over him. He was comforted by the sound of Lennox snoring and the sight of his other two friends sleeping soundly. It was ridiculous. If danger was upon them, they would be no use to him, sleeping as they were. And yet he felt at ease. Lane muttered in his sleep and turned onto his back. Galen gazed down at his square, honest face. He looked so much younger asleep, his mouth half open and childlike. Galen turned his gaze to Lennox. Where Lane was clean-cut and athletic, Lennox was all bulk, with sloping shoulders of tremendous power, barrel-chested, thick-waisted. His hands were huge, and the strength in them was awesome. A year before, he had straightened a horseshoe at the games, having seen it done in the strength test. Too young to be entered, he had shamed several of the contestants and caused great merriment among the Farland clan. Later that day, a dozen youths of the Hayston clan, having seen their man shamed, lay in wait for Lennox as he strode home. They came at him out of the darkness bearing cudgels and thick branches. As the first blow rapped home against his thick skull, Lennox had bellowed in anger and lashed out, sending one luckless youngster through a bush. Two others followed him as Lennox charged amongst them. The rest fled. Galen had heard the story and chuckled. He believed it. He wished he had seen it. To the east, the sky was brightening, and Galen stood and wandered through the trees, on and up, scrambling over the lip of the hollow, to stare at the distant mountains. In the trees around him, birds began to sing, and the eldritch menace of the night disappeared. The boy watched as the snow-capped peaks to the west began to burn like glowing coals, as the sun cleared the eastern horizon. Fields below were bathed in glorious colours, as blooms opened to the golden light. Galen breathed deeply, filling his lungs with the sweet mountain air. He slid back down the slope and burrowed into Lennox's large pack, more than twice the weight of his own, and produced a copper bowl. Stoking up the fire, he placed the bowl upon it, filling it with water and adding the dry oats Meg had wrapped for him. Lane was the first to wake. He grinned at Galen.
No monsters of the night, then?
Galen grinned back and shook his head. Had he remained on the rim of the hollow for a minute more, he would have seen a Farlan hunter racing back towards Campbell's village, his cloak streaming behind him. Bordrick was a skillful huntsman, whose task it was to set the trails for those of the boys travelling towards Valen. He enjoyed his role. It was good to see tomorrow's generation of clansmen testing their mettle, and his son Drigg and foster son Gwalchmai were among them. But today his mind was on other matters. During the night, as he made cold camp by a narrow stream, he had heard the howling that so disturbed Galen and his companions. They had half dismissed it as the hunter's prank. Bordrick knew it was not, for he was the only hunter in the area. Being a cautious man with over 20 years' experience, Bordrick waited until near dawn before checking the source of the cry. With infinite patience, he had worked his way through the wood, keeping the breeze in his face. As it shifted, so too did he. And he found the butchered, broken remains of Erlik of the Pallades. In truth, he didn't know it was Erlik, though he had seen the man many times at the games, but no one could have recognized the bloody meat strewn across the track. Bordrick lifted a torn section of tunic, recognizing the edging as Pallades' weave. In the bushes to the left he found part of a foot. At first he thought it was the work of a bear, but he scouted for tracks and found 6-toed footprints the like of which he had never seen. There were also the tracks of foxes and other small carrion creatures, but they had obviously arrived long after the killing beast had departed. The prints were enormous, as long as a short sword. Bordrick measured the stride. He was not a tall man, neither was he the shortest clansman in the Farlan, but he could not match the stride except by leaping. He gauged the height of the beast as half that again of a tall man, and it walked upright. The deepest impression was at the heel. He followed the track for a little way, until he reached the foot of the slope. Here the spoor changed. The creature dropped to all fours and scrambled up at speed, gouging great tears in the clay. Bordrick dug his fingers into the earth with all his strength, then compared his efforts with those of the killer. He could barely scratch the surface. So, it was big. Bigger than a bear and much faster. It could run on all fours or walk upright like a man. Its jaws were enormous. The fang marks in the leg he had found proved that. He considered following the beast up the slope, but dismissed the idea. From the remains, he could see that the Pallades hunter had been carrying his bow with the arrow notched. He had been given no time to shoot. Bordrick was confident of his own skills, but his strength lay also in the understanding of his weaknesses. Armed with only a hunting knife and a quarterstaff, he was no match for whatever had wreaked this carnage. His one duty was to carry the news to Campbell and clear the mountain of youngsters. Luckily, so he believed, no teams had passed his vantage point, so he would be able to stop any he came across as he returned. By mid-afternoon, every village in the Farlan had the message, and by nightfall 600 clansmen, in groups of 6, were scouring the mountains. By noon the next day, 48 puzzled and disappointed youngsters had been shepherded back to their villages. Only 2 teams remained to be found, those led by Lane and Agwain. At dusk on the second day, Campbell sat with his advisers round a campfire, half a day's march into the mountains.
"They've just vanished," said Leofas. "Lane's group made camp near the Elm Grove, and then moved northeast. After that, the tracks ceased." "It was a cunning ploy," said Bordrick. "They obviously thought they had a clue and didn't wish to be followed. Doesn't make it any easier for us, though, except that we know they didn't head for Valen."
"I disagree," said Caswellan.
"A pox on you, Caswellan," snapped Bordrick. "That was my area. How are you saying that I'm that poor a huntsman?
that I could have missed 8 callow boys.
What I am saying is that we've searched everywhere and found no sign, answered Caswallon softly.
Bodrick snorted. Then maybe it's you who've missed the trail.
Enough of this quarrelling, ordered Campbell. What shall we do now?
Look in Valen, said Caswallon. We have 2 missing teams. Both are led by the brightest, most able of our young men. The rhyme was not easy, but the answer was there for those with the wits to work at it. Agwen, I am sure, would have deciphered it. Do you not agree, Campbell?
Campbell bit his lip and stared into the fire.
Yes, he misses little.
Now, all the boys who headed west say they saw no sign of Agwen or Lane. In fact, after the first night, they just dropped from sight. No team headed for Valen because none of the others deciphered the rhyme. To my mind, the conclusion is inescapable.
So you are saying I'm lacking in skill, stormed Bodrick.
Please be calm, cousin, said Caswallon. We are talking about 2 teams who travelled carefully so that no rivals would spot them. That doesn't mean you lacked skill because you missed them.
I still say they headed west.
Then go west and find them, said Caswallon. I'm heading for Valen.
Bodrick swore, but Campbell cut across him. Hold your tongue, man. And this I think Caswallon is right. Now we have men hunting the west, and we'll lose nothing by visiting Atifos. I just wish that druid would get here. I'd like to know what hell's spawn we're facing.
Well, that druid can help you, said Taliesin, moving out of the tree shadows and seating himself among them.
The beast crossed a gateway, and it is following the youngsters towards Atifos. Caswallon is right. Let these arguments cease.
Are you sure, Lord Druid?
Asked Bodrick.
As sure as death,
answered Taliesin.
You had better move now, for there is tragedy in the air and more blood to be spilt before you find them.
A curse on your prophecies, said Campbell, lurching to his feet. Is this beast more of your magic?
None of mine, Hunt Lord. Have you seen who will die?
Asked Bodrick.
Can you tell us that?
No, I cannot tell you.
But my son is with Agwen.
I know.
Go now, for time is short.
The men rolled their blankets and set off without a backward glance at the druid, whose dark eyes followed them seemingly without emotion. Taliesin watched them go, his heart heavy, a great sadness growing within him. The threads were beginning to come together now. In another time, the sorcerer Jakuta Khan had sent a beast to kill the young Sigani. That beast had vanished into the mists of time. Now it was here, in the Farlan, and being drawn inexorably towards the frail and wounded queen. And between the hunter and his victim were the boys of the Farlan. Taliesin longed to intervene. He remembered the long night sitting at the queen's bedside in the cave on Druin's flanks. He had told her to say nothing of events in her own world, lest the knowledge cause even more fractures in the timelines. But when she became delirious with fever, she had spoken in her sleep, and Taliesin had felt the weight of sorrow bear down on him like a huge rock. He longed to rescue the boys, and he could not.
It rests with you now, Galen, he whispered.
And with the hawk eternal, he thought. The 4 men walked for most of the night, stopping only to snatch an hour's sleep before dawn. Then they moved on, crossing hills, running across narrow valleys, scaling tree-lined slopes. During the afternoon they were joined by 6 hunters cutting in from the east. A hurried conference was held. 1 man was sent back to the village to fetch more bowmen, and the remaining 9 hoisted their packs and ran, single file, towards the towering peaks of the northeast. They drove themselves hard, calling on reserves of endurance built during years of tough mountain living. Only Leofas, the oldest of them, struggled to maintain the pace. But maintain it he did, giving no sign of the pain from his swollen knee. Just before nightfall, Bodrick halted the column, spotting something to the right of the track.
It was a half-eaten oatcake. Baudric picked it up, breaking it into crumbs. At the centre, it was still dry.
"Yesterday,"
he said. Then he scouted carefully around the area. Rather than destroy any faint traces of spore, the other hunters squatted down to wait for Baudric's report. Within minutes, he returned.
"Four lads," he said. "One is very large and can only be Lennox. You were right, Caswallon. They passed me."
The group pushed on into the mountains, and as the sun sank, Caswallon found the hollow Lane had chosen for their camp. The men gathered round.
"Tomorrow should be easier going," said Campbell,
stretching his long legs in front of him and resting his back against the granite boulder.
"The tracks will be easy to find."
His strong fingers kneaded the muscles of his thigh, and he grunted as the pain flowed. Leofas sank to the ground, his face grey, his eyes sunken. With great effort, he slipped his pack from his shoulders and unrolled his blanket. Wrapping himself against the night chill, he fell asleep instantly. Baudric took two huntsmen and began to scour the area. The moon was bright and three quarters full, and the tracks left by the boys would be clearly seen. Baudric followed them halfway up the north slope of the hollow. Here, he stopped. Overlapping Lennox's large footprint was another print twice as long. Baudric swore, the sound hissing between clenched teeth. Swiftly he returned to the men in the hollow.
"The beast is hunting them," he told Campbell. "We must move on."
"That might not be wise," the hunt lord replied. "We could miss vital signs in the darkness. Worse, we could stumble on the beast itself."
"I agree," said Caswallon.
"How close behind them is it, Baudric?"
"Hard to see. Several hours, perhaps less."
"Damn old druids," said Campbell, his broad face flushed and angry. "Damn them and their gates."
Caswallon said nothing. Wrapping himself in his blanket, he leaned back, closed his eyes. He thought of Galen, and wondered if fate could be so cruel as to save the boy on one day, only to have him brutally slain thereafter. He knew that it could. All life was chance. But the gates were a mystery he had never been able to fathom. The elders had a story of a time just before Caswallon was born, when a leather-winged flying creature had appeared in the mountains, killing sheep and even calves. That had been slain by the then Hunt Lord, a strong, proud man who sought to be the first High King since Aerys. But the people had voted against him. Embittered, he had taken 30 of his followers and somehow found a way to cross the churning waters of Attafos to the island of Valon. There, he had overpowered the druids and led his men through the Forbidden Gate. 20 years later, he returned alone, gravely wounded. Taliesin had asked for his death, but the druid council denied him, and the man was returned to the Farlan. No longer hunt lord, he would tell no man of his adventures, saying only that a terrible vision had been revealed to him. Many thought him mad. They mocked him, and the once proud lord took it all, making his home in a mountain cave, where he lived like a hermit. Caswallon had befriended him, but even with Caswallon, the man would not speak of the world beyond the druid's gate. But of the gates themselves he spoke, and Caswallon had listened.
"The feeling as you pass through,"
Oracle had told him,
"is unlike any other experience life can offer. For a moment only, you lose all sense of self, and experience a great calm. Then there is another moment of sense-numbing speed, and the mind is full of colours, all different, moving past and through you. Then the cold strikes marrow deep, and you are human again, on the other side."
"But where did you go?" Caswallon asked.
"I cannot tell you."
The wonder of it, Caswallon knew, was that Oracle had returned at all. There were many stories of people disappearing in the mountains, and even rare occasions when strange animals or birds appeared. But Oracle was the only man he had heard of, save for Taliesin, to pass through and return. There were so many questions Oracle could have answered, so many mysteries he could lay to rest.
"Why can you not tell me?" Caswellan asked.
"I promised the Druids I would not."
Caswellan asked no more. A promise was a thing of steel and ice, and no clansman would expect to break such an oath.
"All will be revealed to you, Caswellan. I promise you,"
Oracle had told him cryptically. Now, as the young clansman sat beneath a moonlit sky, his mind harked back to that conversation. He wasn't at all sure he desired such knowledge. All he wanted was to find the boys and return them safely to the valley. Bordrick prepared a fire, and the men gathered round it silently, fishing in their packs for food. Only Leofas slept. Campbell pushed back the locks of blonde hair from his forehead and wiped sweat from his face. He was tired, filled with the exhaustion only fear can produce. Agwayne was his only son, and he loved him more than anything else the world could provide. The thought of the lad being hunted by a beast from beyond the gates filled him with terror. He could not face the possibility that Agwayne might die.
"We'll find them," said Caswellan softly.
"Yes," answered the Hunt Lord, "but alive."
Caswellan saw the man's angular, honest face twist, as if a sudden pain had struck him. Beneath the wiry yellow-gold beard, Campbell was biting his lip hard, seeking to prevent the collapse into tears of frustration.
"What did you think of the pack incident?" asked Caswellan suddenly.
"What?"
"Gwalchmai dropping his pack and outstripping Agwayne."
"Oh, that. Clever move. Agwayne did not give up, though. He ran him to the end."
"Bear that in mind, Campbell. The boy is a fighter. Given half an opportunity, he will survive."
"The thing will probably seek to avoid man," said Bordrick. "It is the way with animals of the wild, is it not? They know man is a killer. They walk warily round him."
"It didn't walk too warily around the Paladies, Scout," said a balding, bearded clansman from the west.
"True, Beric. But then, from the tracks, the Paladies were stalking it, though I can't see why. Still, it is well known the Paladies are long on nerve and short on brain."
Slowly, as the night passed, the men drifted off to sleep until at last only Campbell and Caswellan remained sitting side by side before the fire.
"It's been a long time since we sat like this, cousin," said Campbell, breaking a lengthy silence.
"Yes, but we walk different paths now. You have responsibility. It could have been yours."
"No," said Caswellan.
"Many would have voted for you."
"They would have been wrong."
"If Agwayne is taken, I shall take my daughter and leave the Farlan,"
said Campbell, staring into the glowing ashes of the dying blaze.
"Now is not the time to think of it," Caswellan told him. "Tomorrow we will talk, as we walk the boys home."
Campbell said nothing more. He unrolled his blanket, curled it round his shoulders, and settled down against his pack. Caswellan stood and made his way slowly up the farthest slope into the deep, cool pine woods beyond. From the tallest point, he gazed to the northeast, seeking sign of a campfire, yet knowing he would see nothing. The boys were too well trained. 16 miles northeast, the four companions were arguing over the choicest morsels of a freshly cooked rabbit. Lennox, who had cooked the coney and served it, was protesting innocence despite his plate bearing twice as much meat as any other.
"But I am beggar," he said seriously.
"My pack carries all the cooking equipment, and it was my snare."
Gwalchmai broke from the argument for long enough to pop a small piece of meat in his mouth and begin chewing. He dropped from the discussion instantly, tugging surreptitiously at Galen's cloak. Galen saw the expression on his face. He tried his own meat, chewed for a moment, then removed the offending gobbet.
Lennox and Lane were still arguing furiously.
"I think Lennox is right," said Galen suddenly. "He is the largest, and he has the greatest burden. Here, take mine too, my friend."
"I couldn't," said Lennox, his eyes betraying his greed.
"No, truly. One small rabbit is scarce enough to build your strength."
Galen tipped the contents of his plate on Lennox's own. In the meantime, Gwalchmai had whispered to Lane.
"I'm sorry, brother," said Lane, smiling. "Galen has made me realize how selfish I am. Take my portion, too."
"And mine,"
added Gwalchmai eagerly.
Lennox sat back on his haunches. "You are all true friends," he said, gazing dreamily at his plate.
Discarding his knife, he scooped a handful of meat into his mouth. For several seconds he chewed in silence. Then his face froze. His three companions waited in nerve-tingling silence until he doggedly finished the mouthful and swallowed.
"Is it good?"
asked Lane, his face set and serious.
"Yes, it is," said Lennox. "But look, I feel bad about taking it all."
"Think nothing of it," said Gwalchmai swiftly. "Your need is the greatest."
"Yes, but..." "And you cooked it," put in Galen.
"I know, but..."
"Eat on, brother," said Lane. "See, it grows cold and... congeals."
The dam burst and all three broke into giggling laughter. Realization struck Lennox, and he hurled the diseased meat into the bushes.
"Swine,"
he said. 100 paces above them, on the edge of the trees, the beast squatted on its haunches, glaring down at the fire. The laughter puzzled it, for the sound was similar to the screeching of the small apes of its homeland. Its black nostrils flared, catching the aroma of scorched flesh, rancid-smelling, sickly flesh. The beast snorted, blowing the scent away. It stretched its powerful legs, moving several paces left. Here the flesh scent was different, warm-blooded, salty and alive. The creature's eyes glittered. Hunger urged it to charge the camp and take the meat. Instinct made it fear the fire. The beast settled down to wait. Galen's dreams were troubled. Once more the Aenir killers pursued him, the pounding of their horses' hooves drumming fear into him as he ran. His legs were heavy, his movements sluggish. Suddenly, a calming blue light filled his mind, and the warriors faded. A face appeared, wrinkled and ancient, only the dark eyes giving a hint of life.
"The fire,"
said a deep, melodious voice, though the lips did not move.
"The fire is dying. Awake."
Galen groaned and rolled over, trying to force the man from his mind.
"The fire, fool! Your life is in danger. Awake!"
The calming light disappeared, to be replaced by a red haze. Within the haze was a monster, black and menacing, its huge jaws slavered and its taloned hands reached for him. Galen awoke with a jolt, eyes opening to the bright moonlight and the glittering stars in the velvet-dark sky. He glanced at the fire. As the dream had told him, it was failing fast, the last flickering twigs turning to ash and glowing embers. The boy did not want to leave the warmth of his blanket, but the dream left an edge of fear in him. He sat up, running his fingers through his hair, scratching at the scar beneath the blaze of white above his left eye. Swiftly he broke twigs and small branches, feeding them to the tiny blaze and blowing life back into the fire. He felt better as the flames danced. A rustling to his right made him turn. A large bush quivered, and a low growl reverberated in the clearing. Galen drew his hunting knife and narrowed his eyes, trying to pierce the darkness. He felt a fool. Had Caswell not warned him endlessly about staring into fires? Now he could not see clearly. A giant shadow rose above the bush, and Galen screamed a warning to the others. Lane rolled from his blanket with knife in hand, standing in a half-crouch beside Galen.
"What is it?"
Galen pointed at the thing beyond the bush. It was at least 8 feet high, its head round like a man's except that the jaws were huge and rimmed with curving fangs. Gwalchmai and Lennox had left their beds and were staring, horror-struck, at the creature. Galen pushed his trembling hand towards the fire, grasping the last of the branches they had stacked. It had not been stripped of its dry leaves, for they would be good tinder for the morning blaze. Lifting the branch, Galen held it over the flames. The leaves caught instantly, flaring and crackling. On trembling legs, Galen advanced towards the beast, holding the torch before him. Lane and Lennox exchanged glances, then followed behind him. Gwalchmai swallowed hard, but he could not force his legs to propel him forward, and stood rooted to the spot, watching his friends slowly advance on the nightmarish beast. It was colossal, near 9 feet in height, and the light from the blazing branch glinted on its dagger-length talons. Galen's legs were trembling as he approached the monstrosity. It reared up and tensed to leap at the youth, but he drew back his arm and flung the blazing brand straight at the creature's face. Flames licked at the shaggy fur around its eyes, flaring up into tongues of fire on its right cheek. A fearful howl tore the silence of the night, and the beast turned and sprang away into the night. The boys watched until it blended into the dark woods. Lane placed his hand on Galen's shoulder.
"Well done, cousin," he said, his voice unsteady. "I'm glad you woke."
"What in the seven hells was that?" asked Gwalchmai, as they returned to the comfort of the fire.
"I don't know," said Lane grimly, "but from the look of those jaws, it's not after berries and grubs."
Gwalchmai retrieved the blazing torch and examined the beast's tracks. Returning to the fire, he told Lane,
"It's the same track we saw in the valley, and we know no hunter made it." "Congratulations, Galen, you saved our lives. There is no doubt of that."
"I had a dream," Galen told him. "An old man appeared to me, warning me."
"Did you recognize him?" asked Lane.
"I think he was the druid with Campbell on hunt day."
"Towerson," whispered Gwalchmai, glancing at Lane.
"What are we going to do?" asked Lennox. "Go back?"
"I don't see that we need to," said Lane. "We turned the beast away easily enough, and most animals avoid man anyway. Also, we'll be at Atterfoss in the morning, so we might just as well see it through."
"I'm not sure," said Gwalchmai. "That thing was big. I wouldn't want to face it without fire."
"If it's hunting us," said Galen, "it can do so equally well whether we go forward or back."
"Are we all agreed then?" Lane asked them.
Gwalchmai longed to hear Lennox suggest a swift retreat back to the valley, but Lennox merely shrugged and donned his pack. Dawn found the companions on the last leg of their journey, climbing the steep, scree-covered slopes of the last mountain before Atterfoss. As they crossed the skyline, the distant roar of the falls could be heard some miles ahead.
"Always roaring, never silent," quoted Gwalchmai. "Whenever I hear it, I feel the hairs rise on the back of my neck."
Lane hitched his pack into a more comfortable position.
"No sign of the beast, anyway," he said,
leading them on down the slope to cross a narrow stone bridge and on to a winding trail through gorse-covered countryside. Lane bore right down a rock-strewn slope and on at last to a narrow strip of black sand nestling in a cove below the falls. Here they loosened their packs and settled down for breakfast. The jutting wall of rock deadened the thunder of the falls, but the wind carried the spray high into the air before them, and the sun made rainbows dance above the camp.
"It occurs to me," said Gwalchmai as they ate, "that we have not come across a single clue. No pouches, no stones marking the trail. It is an unpleasant thought, but we might be wrong."
"I've been thinking that," said Lane, "but then the rhyme is clear. Perhaps the clues are all at the falls."
After the meal, they gathered at the water's edge to indulge in the age-old sport of stone skimming, at which Gwalchmai excelled, beating Lane by 3 jumps. Refilling their water canteens, the boys picked their way up the slope and into the timberline above the falls. Lennox prepared a fire in the afternoon, and Lane suggested a quick search of the woods for clues. Leaving their packs by the fire, they set off to scout, travelling in pairs, Lennox and Lane moving south Galen and Gwalchmai north. From a high point on the hillside, Galen gazed once more at the majesty of Atafos, watching the churning white water thunder to the river below.